This is an interview in the series of interviews for the Simulation Oral History Project. Today we are interviewing Dr. Harry M. Markowitz, and the interview is taking place on February 5th, 2013. And we are at the Markowitz offices in San Diego, California. I am Richard Nance. Our pioneer, Dr. Markowitz, is recognized for his groundbreaking accomplishments in the founding of the SimScript family of simulation programming languages. His innovative ideas led to the SimScript 2 language, which followed a layered design rather unique for the time. His work with the General Electric Company constituted one of the earliest applications of simulation to systems analysis, and in this case, for manufacturing systems. His collaborative work with others at RAND led to programming by questionnaire, arguably the first program generator. He created the EASY entity attribute set-event conceptual modeling language based in part on extensions of the worldview applicated in SimScript, but providing a database capability that was envisioned but not implemented in SimScript 2. In 1989, Dr. Markowitz was awarded the Von Neumann Prize in Operations Research Theory by the two professional organizations that later merged in the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences, INFORMS. He was named a Nobel Laureate in Economics in 1990 for his pioneering contributions in portfolio theory. Dr. Markowitz, thank you for joining us for this interview.
My pleasure.
What led you to discover or encounter simulation in your own professional work?
Originally, my dissertation is on portfolio theory. It uses analytic techniques to trace out risk-return frontiers. When I went to the RAND, my first job out of college was at the RAND Corporation, and RAND was doing simulation there. They were simulating bomber fighter situations, and that's where I learned about simulation.
And RAND, of course, at that time was under Air Force contract
work. Right, it was primarily an Air Force think tank.
Do you remember who introduced you to simulation or who you encountered it working with?
No, it's, you know, it was just sort of like, when did you learn how to do long division? You go to RAND, you find out what's going on, they're doing simulations. Maybe somebody made a presentation at in the auditorium, but it was just in the air.
Who was the person or persons at RAND who influenced you most in your early career?
Well, my early career was mostly in optimization, linear programming. I came to RAND about a year before George Dantzic did, who, of course, is the pioneer in mathematical programming, linear programming. at the invitation of a couple of economists, I learned how the simplex algorithm worked, and I I supervised a programmer who's actually Cliff Shaw, later famous for Newell Simon Shaw Artificial Intelligence. It was their programmer, but we did linear programming as best we could. Then George Dantzic came, and I became Alan Mann, who is a buddy of mine, and I became proteges of George Dantzic.
Are there people there who were connected with simulation who were formative in your ideas, development of your ideas at the time?
Well, let me give you the sequence of events that got me into simulation. I took a leave from RAND in 1955-56, academic, I think it's 55-56, maybe it's 54-55, something like that. I took a leave to write a book which later became Markowitz 1959, Portfolio Selection. When I came back, before that I was in the economics department, mostly doing linear programming. When I came back, they asked me to go into the logistics department, which was a sub-department of economics. And within logistics, there was a logistics laboratory, LP1, Logistics Project 1, or Laboratory Project 1, which was a man, man-machine simulation. There was, we had Air Force people pretending like they were Air Force people, and we had the computer pretending like it was flying sorties and so on and so forth. There were five programs. My job was to supervise the programmers. There were five programmers, some of which are well known now in computer science, Jim Tupac and Jack Little, and three others I can't remember. And we built the computer models, the Air Force simulation models. This was in the days where you take a stack of cards and put them onto a piece of tape, and you run over to the mainframe on the piece of tape and run it, and so forth. In the process of building this model, I should also say that I was also friends with folks at UCLA, a project under Samuelson, Mel Samuelson. That was trying to apply advanced methods to manufacturing, and simulation was necessary there because any complex manufacturing situation is just too hard. It's too complex to solve analytically. So on the one hand, I would kibitz on the use of simulation in manufacturing, and then I was responsible for supervising the programming of these Air Force logistics simulations. When I became convinced that simulation was a great idea, but it was just very hard to program simulation. So I had this little slogan that says, it takes you as long to build a simulation of a factory as it takes to build a factory. Of course, it's cheaper to build a simulation of the factory than actually build the factory. So I had Fortran 2 came out just about then. And I decided, it's got these things called subroutines. Can you imagine Fortran 1 without subroutines? Can you imagine trying to build a large simulation model without subroutines? This theory that you could build reusable subroutines. So that was my theory. After I was done with building LP1, I got an offer from the General Electric Computer Department. It was an offer I couldn't refuse, and I didn't. And I went to Computer Department. The Computer Department really. The General Electric Computer Department didn't understand the role of software in computers. Somehow computers were big electrical machines, and they were used to building big electrical machines like engines and turbines and so on. And this was a different one. So I left the Computer Department for General Electric Manufacturing Services in New York City, 570 Lexington. And there I was at the invitation of Alan Rowe, who had worked with Mel Salveson at the UCLA project. He was just in the process of finishing a big simulator, which was supposed to be flexible because it had many parameters. It was written in assembly language. It was supposed to be flexible because it had many parameters that you could set. This was a job shop simulator. Then when they went from their first job shop to their second job shop, they found that it wasn't all that flexible. I got the opportunity to build for the General Electric small transformer department to build a simulation of their manufacturing facility. using my theory about reusable subroutines, Fortran 2 reusable subroutines. The project I called GEMS, General Electric Manufacturing Simulator. We built it. It worked. The manager of manufacturing was pleased with what he got, and the people were pleased. Then we did courses about how GEMS worked. Then we got our invitation to build a second job shop simulator. And then we found that our flexible subroutines weren't all that, our reusable subroutines weren't all that reusable. So I noticed that what was common from one simulation to another were certain basic acts like creating an entity, filing into a set, causing an event, and so on. So then I had my next hypothesis was we ought to have a language in which that was, in which that could be done easily. And I thought of it in terms of inserts into Fortran. So I looked around for a nice RAND-like environment. I interviewed at IBM Research. I interviewed at AT&T, the Bell Labs. I got a call from, I think, Charlie Zwick at the RAND Corporation. He said, I understand you're in the job market. I said, yes, I'm looking for a nice RAND-like environment. He said, why don't you try RAND? So I went back to RAND. I got offers from RAND and IBM Research. The one from RAND was a couple of $100 more than the IBM Research. And besides, I was delighted to go back to West Coast weather. So at first, we called it SPS-1 simulation pack. Yeah. I can't remember, but we gave it a name, which sort of duplicated. And then somewhere along the way, Herb Carr, I should back up. I went to RAND. I said, I want to work on this language. They gave me Bernie Hausner as a programmer. I had a rough sketch as to what I wanted the language to be. Again, these were inserts into Fortran. I had an idea, you know, how it would go, how it would be implemented. Bernie and I hashed out the fine details of how it would be implemented. He started programming. I picked up Herb Carr as a technical writer. Herb was an entrepreneur, and I had consulted for him now and then. As in his capacity as an entrepreneur, but he had just got fired from Planning Research Corporation and needed a job. So I said, are you willing to write a manual? He said, I'm willing to do anything. So we hired him. And then Herb and I at one time went to the blackboard and tried to get a name for this thing. And since it was simulation, you know, writing, SimScript came out of that. So that's how SimScript started.
Very good. You've touched on the event attribute set, and then the state as a state structure within an event scheduling timing framework, and that of course was indicative of SimScript and what became known as the event scheduling approach. When did you become aware of other approaches in simulation that had a different worldview, I'll use that term?
Now first, Dick, you focus on the event scheduling, but I come from it in a different way. So let me give you my view of, so as of any point in time, the system has a status. The status is described in SimScript in terms of entities. How many of what kind of entities exist? What are the values of their attributes? And what are the sets? You know, who are the members of the sets they own and what sets do they belong to? So that's status. Status changes at points in time called events. Events happen from two different for two different ways. One, they can happen from the outside exogenously. And in the original, we would prepare a deck of cards which would specify at certain points of time what events would occur and what extra parameters they would have. Sorry. And a particular event might cause one or more subsequent events. So those would be endogenous events as compared to exogenous events. Now, since the model is asynchronous, we had to have a timing mechanism to keep track of the ranked set. In general, SimScript was an entity attribute and set oriented language. Sets were either LIFO, FIFO, or ranked, ordered by one or more attributes of the members. And so from our point of view, the timing mechanism just was one. It kept a ranked set of events ordered by time with information as to who called and what arguments were trying to be passed. The timing routine would ask, what is the most imminent event, and the transfer control to that. So that's my, that's how the event timing just sort of falls out as a byproduct of the view.
And in an excellent tutorial, I might say.
I thank you much. I was tempted to use this whiteboard over here, but the camera is not it.
Could you briefly describe also, you did work in sparse matrices and sparse matrix techniques, and do you see a connection between that work, your work in portfolio selection, and your work in simulation?
Well, there are connections which have to do with how did I find these and what was I trying to do and how is this related to the theory of rational decision making under uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one didn't lead to the other. They are parallel trains of thought. I should tell you that I'm not primarily known for simulation. I make a living out of portfolio theory, and simulation is, SimScript is dear to my heart, and I'm sorry it never got fully implemented. But a lot of people think that I'm in finance. But a lot of other people know that finance is just an application of operations research. So a lot of people think I'm an operations research guy, but I'm really a philosopher. When I was in high school, instead of doing homework, I would read philosophers like Hume, who said that that even though I release this ball and it falls downward each time, it has fallen down each time. That's no proof positive that it will fall next time. So I read Hume and Descartes, who said, what do I really know? And he finally decided the only thing I know is I think, therefore I am. And so, when I came to University of Chicago, and finally ended up in the economics department, I became especially interested in the economics of uncertainty. And the person who most formed my view is Leonard J. Savage, who wrote a book called Foundations of Statistics that made half the world Bayesians. And Savage, even though he might not think of himself as a philosopher, really answered, in my mind, the questions which Descartes and Hume had put it, like, what do we really know? And Savage's book finesses that question by saying, don't ask what do we really know, ask how we should act. How should we act in a face of uncertainty? Portfolio theory obviously is an attempt to make practical the theory of rational decision making for investment. Simulation is there because there are kinds of things you cannot solve analytically in the practical application of sparse matrices. somewhere I did a stint in optimization. Portfolio theory involved some computations. How do you solve these things? So I became a quadratic programming guy. As I mentioned before, when George Dantzic came, I started to really learn computing. Alan Mann and I were building large models, economic models, linear programming models of the economy. This was at RAND, which is an Air Force think tank. This was the day when the A-bombs were small enough so you could talk about what was the effect of bombing this industry versus that industry. Our linear programming models were very large for the computers of that day. I noticed, just looking at these models, that they were very sparse. While everything was connected to everything else, ultimately, any one activity involved very few resources or products and so on. And that is what led to the development of these sparse matrix techniques. So this is all in the pursuit of how, in practice, should we act under uncertainty.
And I think you said that you did not progress from one to the other. These were your thoughts in all of these areas were going on in a rather parallel.
In parallel, frame of they would. I would focus on one area and then focus on another. So when I was at the University of Chicago, I focused on portfolio theory because that became my dissertation, and I took a leave from RAND and spent 9 months, an academic year, at the Coles Foundation. I had been a student member of the Coles Commission. I was at Chicago and moved to Yale at Jim Tobin's invitation. I went there. And so there I was focused on portfolio theory. Then when I moved to RAND and we had simulation to do, I was focused on simulation. That was before I went to General Electric. When I came back from General Electric, of course, I told you what I was doing at General Electric. I was focused on SimScript. Later, when I started teaching finance again, then I had to go focus on what did Black and Scholes do when behind my back when I wasn't looking, and things like that.
Your period working in simulation extended for quite a long time. I'm interested in how you would characterize the technology change in computing that supported the work over that period.
I answer your questions sometimes in terms of portfolio theory, and sometimes in terms of simulation, and sometimes in sparse matrices. So as far I've gone from one to the other, and computing is something that's a common denominator to all of them. Let me tell you about the first mean variance frontier I computed for my book, my risk return. I was at the Coles Foundation. I was taking a leave from RAND, and I was at the Coles Foundation. I had to compute these covariances and so on. Now, one of the major differences between then and now is how we got the data. Then, in order to get the time series that I used in my 9 security plus cache illustrative example in my 1959 book, Coles hired, I imagine, a student to go over to the library to get out the old get out the old files, look up the closing dates of the Wall Street Journal each year to get the closing prices for each of these securities and compute returns from that, probably ignoring dividends. And that was the way we got the data by going over to the library and hand. Now data comes from heaven, you know, it's in the cloud. You just punch in and it comes down. As far as computing, I had, I think it was called a 6028, I'm not really sure. It was a card punch machine. It had a wire board, you know, we plugged in the wires. It would go through 16 program steps, and each program step could read data from card, transfer to registers, do computations in registers, punch cards. And if you had more than 16 steps worth of stuff, you had to punch out your intermediate results onto a cards and then recycle it. So you'd have maybe two punch boards, maybe a punch board to do covariances, a punch board to get efficient, you know, efficient frontiers. Nice thing about that, it was nice and slow. That has a certain advantage. You'd put a deck of cards into the hopper, and this machine would go chuggity-chug, 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 and you could read a book. And then suddenly you notice it wasn't going chuggity-chug anymore. And then you realized you had to. So when I got back to the RAND Corporation, they had an IBM 701, big, powerful machine. I think we figured 32,000 words of memories, 36 bits, so it might have had a few hundred thousand bits of memory. You know, not like a good cell phone these days, but air conditioned. If it was a hot day, you could always go stand in the computer room, and so on. And so that's where it started.
Beyond the institutions that you have mentioned, and you have mentioned several, if we consider the Air Force an institution or an organization that supported your work, the Coles Foundation, are there any other institutional or organizational support sources that you would like to identify?
I know RAND had the Air Force as its primary customer at that time. I don't think of myself as having, I never thought of myself as working, having worked for the Air Force. I worked for the RAND Corporation. So the major organizations in my life were first the Coles Commission. I was a student member of the Coles Commission and got exposed to some very bright people, at Coles. Then I moved to the RAND Corporation and again got exposed to some very bright people. I suppose I should start back at the University of Chicago, of which the Coles was, as you went up to the third floor, whatever it was, and stepped out of the elevator, the Coles Commission was on the left and Milton Friedman and his colleagues were on the right. I think they especially positioned them that way. And I learned a lot there. Like I told you about Leonard J. Savage being, he was my professor. Not only did I read his book, but I'm a good friend of his son, Sam Savage. I'm a good friend, and I tell Sam that I became a Bayesian from his father at point blank range. And the University of Chicago was very important in my development. The RAND Corporation, I was at RAND maybe a better part of 10 years over the course of, then working with very bright people at CACI, the organization that Herb and I founded to develop SimScript, to exploit SimScript commercially. My stint at General Electric, I've got something out of order, I've got something out of chronological order, but my stint at General Electric and my opportunity to try out a theory. And then IBM Research. I spent many, many years at IBM Research, which gave me an opportunity to develop the EASY, EAS-E, entities, attributes, sets, and events, database capability, and then I was at Baruch College for many years and had interesting colleagues to bounce ideas off of. And then I came back to West Coast, set up a consulting business. I have some very interesting, you know, colleagues. Now, I'm right now writing a book, which is going to come out in four parts. Part one, which will be a separate volume, volume one, volume two, volume, is due at the publishers March 31st of this month, McGraw-Hill, and March 31st of this year at McGraw-Hill. It's sponsored by one of my clients, First Global, pays me. I work on retainers. I don't try to keep track of my time. Each of my clients, we figure out roughly how much on the average I'll spend with them per month, how many hours per month, and we multiply it by my hourly fee, and that's what they pay me as retainer. First Global, I have a decent, you know, hour, you know, number of hours for them, and what I don't use actually helping them do portfolio analysis, I'm encouraged to do writing my book, and in fact, my book is my residual claimant. But in general, my interactions with clients like Guided Choice, which is a 401k advisory service, and First Global, and others. There's several others. So each of these steps, each of these stages, have given me an opportunity to work on things I was interested in with people who I found very interesting.
Do you care to mention the title of the forthcoming book?
Yes. It's called Risk Return Analysis, and the subtitle is The Theory and Practice of Rational Investing.
Sounds something that I could benefit from. You've mentioned a common element of each place you've been as having a strong influence, and that is good people around you.
Yes.
And would you say that that is probably the biggest factor in a success in the varied fields within which you've worked?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, a lot of people have been at similar places with similar colleagues and haven't had that much success. But I've thought about what's different about me, because you pointed out before I had the von Neumann Prize, from which you recognize three things. Then over on the shelf over there, there's a you know that in finance there's a big dispute between the rational theorists and the behaviorists, and I have a handbook on behavioral finance, three volume, and the third volume is a collection of early papers on behavioral finance, and the first paper in that volume is Harry Markowitz, 1952b, Utility of Wealth. So I also am, I am not only the father of portfolio theory, but I'm the grandfather of behavioral finance, and the behavioral finance, so, you know, welcome me. And we have disputes internally whether the certain curve is this way or that way. So they think of having at least a fourth discovery. And recently at a conference honoring the 60th anniversary of my 1952 paper last year, somebody asked, well, if you had your, you know, in reviewing the von Neumann, von Neumann Prize, they said, if you were listing your great discoveries, wouldn't you also list the Markowitz Van Dyke paper of how to crack the curse of dimensionality of linear programming by this quadratic surrogate method? I said, yes, I would do. So there's five times lightning has struck. And so what's different about me? Now, first place, I'm not a genius like von Neumann, who could do mental arithmetic. I can hardly do arithmetic, much less mental arithmetic. I don't have a photographic mind, and so I'm a plotter. I have a fair intelligence, like I think if I may be so bold to pick out a great name that preceded me, I think of Darwin as a plotter, as distinguished from Einstein, who was a a genius. So I'm a plotter, but I'm a very conscientious plotter. And many of these things have come in moments of insight, not SimScript, that took a long time. But take portfolio theory. I was reading John Burr Williams' Theory of Investment Value towards doing a dissertation on portfolio, on the stock market. He said that value of a stock is the present value of its future dividends. And I thought, dividends are uncertain. He must mean expected value. And later he does confirm he means expected value. So I thought, well, if you were only interested in the expected value of a security, you must be only interested in the expected value of a portfolio. And it's easy to show that if you're only interested in the expected value, you maximize the expected value of a portfolio by putting all your money in one basket, all your eggs in one basket, putting all your money in whatever has the highest expected value and so on. And just, reading the book conscientiously and thinking through a little bit, trying to think through a little bit of the implications of what this is, sort of led me down that path. The story about how I figured out, became the grandfather of behavioral finance. Again, I was just reading carefully a paper by Friedman and Savage, which Friedman had assigned, and thinking through its implications, which turned out to be absurd unless you assume this, this, and this, and that became sparse matrices. I'm just sitting there looking at these big matrices with mostly zero coefficients. I could see that if I try to solve these by hand, if I pivoted correctly, I could practically solve these by hand, so why can't the computer do it? So I just sort of conscientiously look at one problem at a time, try to think through the verifiable implications if it's a hypothesis, or try to think about, isn't there an easier way to do it if it's an operations research problem, think about what the implications are for behavior if it is advice. I just very conscientiously read, and these things fall out.
When I think about that characterization with respect to SimScript, one of the things that comes back at me is the beauty of the language in its representation of a world concept that can be implemented in the event, the entity attribute set, an event. But also, there were many solutions, technical solutions, that were quite pragmatic. The typing of your sets, the ordering of sets, the ragged arrays. Did that come in part because you had these interactions with the programmer and yourself and the writer?
Yes. A lot of detail comes out of interaction with individuals. With SimScript 1, it was Bernie Hausner, who was the programmer, Herb Carr was the writer, and I was sort of the designer. With SimScript 2, Villanueva was the programmer, Phil Kiviat was the writer. SimScript 2 was one of the things I had to figure out for SimScript 2 is how to implement this very complex language. It's something where compiler folks who are used to having languages where you can translate from left to right and keep going, well, that's very fast, but we don't need fast anymore. SimScript was a much richer language and couldn't be implemented that way. So one of the intellectual struggles I had, which I did while sitting on mostly in park benches on the shores of the Pacific in Santa Monica, was how do you implement this? And I have an article called SimScript in the Encyclopedia of Encyclopedia of Computer Science and Technology, also reprinted in my selected works, which describes a entity attribute, and among other things, this article describes my solution to the problem of compiling these things. Namely, I have an entity attribute and set version view of the compiling process, which is what allowed us to. It turned out this was very tricky to program. The first, when I went back to RAND, they gave me a programmer who just couldn't cut it. Then Bernie Hausner came back from world travels and was with me long enough to get to program enough of SimScript 2 so that we could recompile SimScript 2 in SimScript 2. Then he said, Richard Villanueva reminds me of me when I was younger. He will be your programmer. And then we recruited Phil Kiviat to be our writer, and that's how that came about.
There was also the interesting relationship that Bernie Hausner did spend some time with the Simula project in,
right.
In Norway.
He's somewhere between the time when he programmed SimScript 1 and the time he returned and programmed SimScript 2. He did spend some time with that group in Norway.
Do you recall any of the conferences which were popular during the mid-60s on simulation programming languages, some comparisons, some discussions? I'm thinking of primarily work done by Dan Tycro and John Lubin. Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, I remember. John Lubin was a good friend. I don't remember I remember GPSS. Mm-hmm. That was our serious rival. There were other languages, but they never really got off the ground in terms of popularity. Mm-hmm. I remember Lubin and Tycro. I remember presentations. I remember going to conferences. I remember being at a conference where everybody, each of the speakers got up and said why their language was better than SimScript. And I remember one guy behind me whispering to the next guy behind me saying, hey, we got to look into this SimScript thing.
Considering the current state, or your perception of the current state of discrete event simulation, would you care to comment on what you see as a future?
I haven't been, I told you I focus on one thing, I focus on another. Right now I'm focused on finishing volume one of a book in portfolio theory.
Right.
And after that I'll be focused on volume two, volume three, and volume four. Since I'm 85, there's also provision in my contract with McGraw-Hill as to what happens if I, poop out midway in a volume. I once in a while look at announcements. I see that I don't see any particular programming language being front and central. It seems to be people are rediscovering the same wheels that we discovered in the 60s, but I may be in error in that manner. So I would hope that maybe SimScript 3 would become the future programming language of the world, but it doesn't seem to be going in that direction very fast.
Have you read, there has been a spate of papers and a good bit of interest in the last few years in financial simulations.
Right.
Have you read any of the material?
Yeah, I keep track. One of the things I've done recently myself, I spent a considerable amount of time programming a asynchronous simulation of a market. I realize there's other simulations. There's a book on my shelf by Chaim Levy and his son, Moshe Levy, on micro financial simulation and so on. So I've kept up with that. What I did was a simulation where I used the I didn't use SimScript because it would have been expensive to my client, and then they couldn't have used it, well, for various reasons. For business reasons, I didn't use SimScript. But I programmed in a SimScript, from a SimScript point of view. I have a website called easy.org, EAS-E.org, where you can get, you can find C, or C++, I should say, C++ subroutines, which will help you do filing and removing from ranked sets. Of course, once you could do ranked sets, it's easy to do event-oriented, simulation. So I built a large simulator with two colleagues. It's called the JLM Sim, Jacobs Levy Markowitz Simulator. We've had some publications out on it, where you had entities like investors and portfolio analysts and statisticians and traders and orders and so on. And there were sets like all the set of all buy orders ranked by price, and the set of all set or and so on, and the events like reoptimize and and so on and so forth. So, but over and above that, I have been keeping track of the, but these are usually as I said, I programmed in C++, and the others usually are just in some programming language.
Mm-hmm. And looking at your work in simulation, was it used, has it been used as you anticipated or expected, or have there been any unintended or surprising consequences?
Well, it was, SimScript 1 was used at RAND. SimScript 2 was used widely. SimScript 2 and SimScript 3 are still active, are still, good products at CACI. But the reason why you don't hear a lot about them is that the CACI's business model is one of leasing or selling, or leasing a few copies in effect to at a very high price to very large, to very large clients like the Air Force and the Army and so on. I understand from Anna Marjansky, who's in charge of this project at CACI, that there's worldwide simulation of battles and things like that. So it's a good profit center for CACI, but it isn't something that's priced for the popular market.
Sort of drawing to a close here, what aspects of your research, technical contributions to the profession, I should probably say professions, do you regard as having had the greatest impact?
Clearly, portfolio theory. I think certainly hundreds of billions, maybe literally trillions of dollars are managed with the aid of portfolio theory. Now, a lot has been added to the original concept in my 1952 article and 59 book that you should think about the risk and return on the portfolio as a whole. And if you use variance as the measure of risk or standard deviation, then you have to worry about covariances and so on. That was the basic concept. But various people have added, like Gary Brinson convinced people that the asset allocation decision, what asset classes that you should invest in, was tremendously important, was sort of the basic decision. You've got to get your asset classes right, and then you can figure out how to. So risk-return analysis at the asset class level is done by by consultants to large institutions, by financial advisors, CFAs, and so on and so forth. Guided Choice is my Thursday client. That's why you're not here on a Thursday. We do that kind of thing. Models of covariance and data series, Ibbotson data series, and so on, have flushed out that from being a thought to being an industry, and that's clearly the biggest impact I've had. My largest regret is that SimScript 2, its seven levels were never fully implemented.
Yes, I think you made that comment at the keynote address at the Winter Simulation Conference.
Right.
What advice would you give to a student who's interested in doing his work or her work in simulation?
Well, I don't have advice specifically in simulation. I have advice generally. The old saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So first you should be broadly educated in the techniques of operations research. You should know about simulation and optimization and, you know, Markov processes and so on. You should, for me, it started with learning philosophy and reading Hume and Descartes and so on. So maybe that's not where you start. It includes understanding the notion of proof. Hume distinguished between empirical things, which you cannot have any certainty, and relationships among ideas. And relationships among ideas is logic and math, and you should understand. In other words, you should, when you pick up a field, you should try to understand it fundamentally, from first principles. You know, you should do a good job of understanding whatever it is you are doing. And at an intellectual level, you should understand, you know, what's demonstrable one way, what's demonstrable another way. You should acquire a body of technique. And as you float through the world, you should optimize as you go along.
Dr. Markowitz, I want to thank you. It has been a very, very real pleasure to talk with you. And we are certainly delighted to have this interview as part of the oral history.
It has really been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.